This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Hite.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
And with brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Prelude scenes.
Obsolete words.
60s fantasy film essentials.
And Alexandra David Niel.
Well, I sure am glad President Cat greenlit the Catstronauts' mission to expand the International Space Station. I hear he signed the authorization by swatting a pen across the floor. True leadership right there.
Giant laser pointers in space? What's not to like? And even better, the space station has live stream cameras. Although, half the time it's just nose boops. Let's check how the Catstronauts are doing up there on the space station.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Here comes the kitty technician, Blanket. Careful, Waffles. If he catches you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, then it's back to litter box duty for you.
Wait a second, Robin. Major Meowser just got a hair-raising transmission from HQ. Is that the new napping module on its way?
Yep, it's their first space station edition. Science Officer Pom-Pom better know what to do, or there'll be a... catastrophe in 3, 2, 1.
Here she is, and she's sharpening her claws on the instruction manual. Well, it might accidentally flip to the right page with enough swiping, I guess.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady with his prodigious belly. Blanket is swatting at the module's fasteners like a feather toy. Pom-Pom finally found the right instructions, and Major Meowser is, napping on them? Teamwork, by golly!
Hooray for the Catstronauts!
The space station is saved!
Until the next module arrives and starts another near catastrophe, that is.
Wow, managing your own space station with a crew of feline heroes. Now that's the life!
You know you can, Robin. The official Catstronauts board game is available now from Atlas Games. It's full of pawsome color art by the comic book's creator, Drew Brockington, and Catstronauts features cooperative play that's fun for all ages. Find out more at atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
Sounds like the Catstronauts board game is perfect for the whole family. Let's meet this stellar challenge by picking up the Catstronauts board game now!
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the mudroom on the outside of the gaming hut, where we have to take off our boots and hang our coats because Mom doesn't like us tracking mud into the shag carpet of the gaming hut. But the reason we're hanging out in the mudroom instead of going right on into the gaming hut is because today we're talking about prelude scenes. And whether or not they are sort of unrelated teasers, or if they're just things that you're doing until you get to the fireworks factory, they all count as a different kind of a challenge, both to design and then also, I think, to run and to keep people's interest in. So, Robin, why don't you break out what you see as Prelude 001, the prelude to Prelude 101.
Right. So as a prelude to this discussion, I will define further what this means, which is these are scenes that are happening with the player characters in them, and the objective of the scenario has yet to reveal itself. So the characters have a strong feeling that they're on site for something that's going to happen. And the most classic version of this is you go to a cozy Edwardian manor where all sorts of different eccentric characters are gathered. And guess what? In scene 2, or possibly in scene 3, or if you're actually following the structure of a lot of cozy mysteries, scene 14, the murder occurs and then the real action begins. Or a group of you all go to the cabin in the woods for a while and you've heard rumors of a strange thing in the woods, but you're unconcerned by that. Or I don't know what would the F-20 equivalent of this sort of scene be?
This is, you've gone to the tavern, but you haven't met the guy in the corner.
Right. So the whole point of this is you're setting something up. The players know that you're setting something up, but they don't know what they're supposed to do. And what is especially deadly in any game, particularly anything with sort of a mystery focus or where the players expect there to be a sort of a non-sandboxy objective, right? They're not just expected to poke around the environment and find something to do. They know there will be a mission imminently, but unlike their fictional counterparts, they might want to already start doing that, or they might be impatient for you to just fast forward and get to it. So how do you structure those scenes and make them work and have them on stage basically for setup without their becoming restive or engaging in metagaming? Because the worst thing is a scenario where they know they're supposed to be doing something, but they don't yet know what that something is.
Yeah, there's a couple of things. First, ideally, the players enjoy playing their characters as their characters. So you can provide things that spark character action or character joy without necessarily being the scenario's objective. So if one of the characters is a clothes horse, they show up and, they've gone to the Edwardian mansion, and then you get to describe everyone's clothing. And, you say, what did you pack to make sure that you fit in with these swank swells? And then they get to describe that. And, the character likes to smash stuff up. Maybe they've got to do a little interpersonal play. They're friendly rivals with the elf, so they get to banter with the elf a little bit. Or you're just basically saying, the butler has unpacked your bag in the room. You go up and check it. Tell us where in the bag you've hidden your gun, and then lovingly describe your gun a little bit. Just let us set the scene. Let us know what you've brought to this swanky weekend at the country house where surely nothing could possibly go wrong.
Another thing is to do the old switch objectives trick. Because if you just say, well, you're at a party, what do you do? First of all, that sets anyone who's a remotely experienced gamer or watcher of narratives to the alert of, oh, well, there's going to be a murder, or a monster is going to come through the door, or obviously the orcs are about to attack the tavern because they didn't listen to last week's episode of Ken and Robin and know that that's a bad idea. So that just, gets them all on edge and gets them waiting and gets them perhaps over alert. Possibly over alert in a way that spoils the plot of what you're supposed to do, right? If you suspect there's going to be a murder, you go, well, who's the most murderable person here? Oh, well, it's clearly the old colonial administrator. He seems kind of murderable. Let's put a 24-hour watch on him so that no murder occurs, and, dismiss all of the butlers because they're clearly going to do it. You don't want that. You got to avoid that. So The thing to do is to give them another objective. That is the sort of the false flag, as it were, the thing that they think the scenario is about until the thing happens. So, for example, in the Edwardian manner, you have been sent there to find the spy. And when you get there, it turns out there's a murder mystery. And the way to, in that case, to most elegantly segue from finding the spy to doing the murder mystery is, it was the spy who was murdered. And you have some reason. That's part of your, you are told with your bureaucracy ability, well, obviously the agency is now going to want you to find out who murdered the spy, because they probably have the secret papers the spy had on them. And so that way you can seamlessly move from the apparent objective to an actual objective. And you never have the players going, well, what are we supposed to do other than just, interact like a bunch of role players?
And that sort of switcheroo can be great fun, especially if the first objective is the sort of thing that could be accomplished pretty easily within a single act, right? You're meant to show up and make sure that, the spy is located. You're going to heist the emerald. You're going to do a thing. And then once you get there, presto, it's also a monster hunt, or it's also a murder mystery, or it's also whatever else. So maybe you are still trying to heist the emerald in between investigating the murder, but you don't have a very constrained, this could have been a die roll adventure. You've got, oh, I see, we did this, and then we got a fun, exciting murder mystery happened, or a fun, exciting monster attack. I think one of the greatest versions of this is where they start as a heist, and it turns into a monster, or it turns into a murder. And I think that's the best thing in Dracula 2000, is that it begins as a heist movie, and then suddenly it's Dracula, and oops, well, that was exciting. But you can certainly run versions of that, everything from heist to interfere with this burgeoning romance that's bad for the kingdom to you're just there because this is the old quest giver and he's giving his 50th birthday party and you're all invited and he's going to take you aside and give you the, you know, the hat and so that you can sit in the tavern and give quests. But of course, he's been murdered and now you have to solve a murder and avenge the death of your beloved patron who sent you to so many dungeons with only a small expectation of reward. What a great guy he was.
And the trick there is to make sure that the apparent mission is interesting enough that it doesn't give the game away, that it's a fake mission, and interesting enough that they want to engage with it, but not so interesting that the actual mission turns out to be a disappointment.
Right. It's like, oh, I want to do a heist, not fight werewolves.
Right. And that's where we get to the other part, which is, except if they have no choice but to engage with it, right? So if there's a murder downstairs while you're conducting the heist, you probably want to just continue with the heist. You go, oh, great, there's another distraction. That's not our business. But if werewolves are coming at you while you're performing the heist, you have no choice but to switch objectives. The objective is thrust upon mm-hmm. you. And you may still have people say at the end, I just wanted to do a heist. It was great until the werewolf showed up. So there's that. But at least you don't have the, and then I didn't know what to do. Or, you know, the famous thing where the players decide to reject the premise of the adventure because the, in this case, the prelude thing you've given them to do turns out to be more exciting than the main thing. And so the first solution to that is ask yourself what's interesting and do what's interesting. But in a pinch, if they surprise you by being more interested in the fashion show than in the discovering who it is who's smuggling green slime, you find a way to hook the one thing into the other, right? That you will never succeed in stealing the designs for this year's fashions from the sinister couturier unless you also deal with the green slime. So that just as you use a red herring in a role-playing game to move people back into the story instead of away from the story, you can have a plan B for what happens if they still remain determined to do the preliminary story instead of the real story, find a way to hook that back into so that they become one story.
And with some of this, you can do basically an implicit threat or a ticking clock. A Knights Black Agents would be almost trivial for this. They've shown up. They think that there's, you know, vampires are casing this museum. They've shown up to the museum to check it out on a gala night. The museum is robbed or there's a murder or whatever, and the cops shut the museum down and no one can leave until we find out who did this murder. And they know that their cover, while good enough to get them into the museum, is not good enough to withstand the full attention of the police nationale. And so they have to solve the murder before the 24 hours that their ID lasts is up. And that can provide a fun sort of a combo play. And then ideally, the identity of the murderer is also related to whatever the vampires were up to. And even if the killer wasn't a vampire or even a Renfield, they were still part of the conspiracy and they've still gotten the reward for having gone and, you know, gone to the museum in the first place.
And the final piece of advice is to start the preliminary apparent plot as late into that story as you possibly can. So that instead of going, well, and now you get on the coach to drive to the manor. No, it's you're at the manor and the party is already in progress, and then collapse the time so that it's not like, and on day three of your weekend at the cabin, the slime molds attack. It's like you've got time for one scene, right? You're cutting in just as everybody's, the party is starting to turn from the joyous part of the party to the grumpy part of the party. And it's midnight and the slime molds come at 2 in the morning so that there's not a long extended time, again, for the players to run out of the preliminary plot before they get to the main plot.
On a kindred note, cutting as close to the action as you can prevents people from getting so invested in the prelude plot with a bunch of planning and recon and faffing around that then they feel cheated that they weren't allowed to do their heist or whatever because there was a stupid werewolf attack. And that sort of a kindred thing, I was enjoying it too much. it's also, I was too invested. So, you know, you cut to the them alone in the room with the emerald safe and start rolling. And that's when you, you know, hear the rattle of werewolves busting through the windows downstairs and trouble begins to ensue.
Right. I suppose in a regular game at home, you have the freedom if you discover that the players want to squeeze hours worth of activity out of the party at the beginning or the trip to the cabin, that you can run with that and then have the almost sort of let them succeed at whatever the false mission is. And then the revelation of the actual mission is the cliffhanger. And then they come back next week and have a whole session with that. But obviously that's something that only works in that format. It's not going to work at a one shot at a convention, for example.
Right. Yes. Well, on the topic of cliffhangers, having established the prelude being the prelude segment, we now switch into the exciting real adventure, which is to say, the commercial, and then a hut on the other side of it.
...1968.
Sinister influences threaten to corrupt America from within and without.
The federal government establishes a new agency for overseas covert action.
The Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, the BNDD.
And within it, the forces of Delta Green.
In the Borealis Connection, the new globe-spanning mega-campaign for the fall of Delta Green, you become the mythos-hunting agents hidden inside the BNDD.
Play 8 linked operations.
As separate standalones.
Or linked into an epic hunt for an infamous target.
Escort a sniper carrying a death warrant for a Shan warlord.
Surveil a Saigon drug summit.
Track heroin couriers on a flight from Hong Kong to L.A.
Investigate the disappearance of an archaeologist working the Bozukepi ceremonial site.
Smash a Beirut drug deal.
ID the actors broadcasting the Necronomicon from a CIA backed Munich radio station.
And wage the drug war amid France's May 68 riots.
Designed by Kenneth Haidt.
Written by Gareth Ryder Hanrahan.
The team that brought you the Zelazny Quartet and the Dracula dossier.
The Borealis Connection.
Gorgeously designed and horrifically illustrated by Jen McCleary.
A tale of sordid intrigue.
Cosmic horror.
And desperate action against the mythos.
Now available in Titanic hardback.
From specially cleared gaming retail stores.
And the Pelgrane Press web store.
Now also at the web store as an instantly available PDF-only purchase.
Ken and I are both game designers, but we're also writers. And what is the number one tool in the trade of the writer? The word. So therefore, we are going to go to that most important hut, the hut that precedes all other huts in our endeavors, the word hut. And this time around, I'm going to list a series of rare, obscure, sometimes even deprecated words. And Ken is going to, first of all, see if he can intuit their meaning. And then we are going to perhaps delve a bit into their roots, where the word comes from. And then at the end, we will decide which of these words deserves to enter common usage. So let us start, Ken, with a word that perhaps both of us relate to, orgulous. Do you have an idea what orgulous means, first of all?
Going from bibulous, which means full of drink, I would say that orgulous would be full of life.
Very close, or certainly very close for the two of us. Full of pride. You're proud. It's an 11th century term. It comes from Middle English with Frankish roots.
Ah, well, pride and life, basically the same thing.
Our next term, catagalastic.
Catagalastic.
Catagalastic with a K for listeners at home.
With a K.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would be snapping back, right?
In a way it is. It's showing a predilection for mocking humor. Humor at the expense of others. Now, this has Ooh. Greek roots, but it's actually a relatively new word that comes from recent psychology papers from like 2018. So this is a brand spanking new, hot off the presses word.
Brand spanking
it's
new
like,
word.
You seem a little catagalastic today. The next one, I thought I'd throw in an easy one for you. Omnivalent. Omnivalent.
That means, obviously, of all value.
Very close.
Means everything.
Yeah, almighty, all-powerful, or omnipotent, which is a...
Oh.
This might sneak ahead because it's a word that we can put to use, and because we need different synonyms for all-powerful and omnipotent.
Right, exactly. The omnivalence of blank.
Another one that we could both make use of if we select it for common usage, tenebricose. Tenebricose.
Please tell me that's when your blood turns black.
More generally, it is dark or gloomy, full of darkness. This is from the 1700s, and it's a learned borrowing from Latin. So are you familiar with the concept in etymology of the learned borrowing?
The learned borrowing?
Yeah.
I mean, I know generally what it is, but I assume that that is a specific coinage. So unveil.
So that is when a fancy person, a writer like you and I, makes up a new word. So it's a Latin word, but it was made up in the 1700s from Latin by a writer or scholar. And so the previously mentioned catagalastic is also a learned borrowing. Next, we come to another one that you might be able to figure out from context. It's oblocutor. What is an oblocutor?
An oblocutor surely has to be someone who prevents you from talking.
Or in this case, again, very, very close. It's a gainsayer or critic. So someone who, after you've talked, disagrees with you. And so this is from the early 1600s and is another learned borrowing.
Right. So it's interlocutor, but not helpful.
Exactly. You're a blocutor, as it were.
It's amazing that they had this before the internet.
Yeah. Another one, I've leaned toward words that you and I and other role-playing writers might want to use. Teratomorphous.
That means capable of or in the process of changing into a monster, surely.
That is exactly right, having the shape or form of a monster.
At some level, my patchy Greek will come through.
This is another learned borrowing, speaking of patchy Greek, and it comes from the mid-1800s in scientific literature when suddenly natural historians are very interested in the malformed and the weird and the creature-like. So a creature that is teratomorphous, that's something we could both plunk into a manuscript tomorrow if we select that as our chosen word. Now we come to plurisecular.
Plurisecular would mean many ages or something like that. So I assume this is something that would be true across centuries or milieus, maybe?
That is exactly correct. Ding, 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 ding. This is a learned borrowing from 1903.
Boom.
And penultimately, we come to lutulent.
I'm going to say that it means producing enjoyable or beautiful light.
It is from Latin, but it is sort of the opposite of that. It is pertaining to mud or muddy. So it is from the Latin word for mud. So you were prescient when you mentioned the mud room at the top of this episode.
Okay.
And then finally, we're going to go a little more literary with the final one, bawcock. For those listening at home, that's B-A-W-C-O-C-K, bawcock.
That has got to be some sort of literary coinage. And I'm going to guess just from the euphony of it that a bawcock is someone who is a braggart or a loudmouth.
In fact, it means a good boy or apple of my eye. So it's used by Shakespeare in A Winter's Tale. There's a touching moment showing the good side of King Leontes. He addresses his young son Mamilius and says, "Olfax, why, that's my bawcock."
That's my bawcock.
My bawcock. You could say that to Warren, for example.
I could.
So of these words, orgulous, catagalastic, omnivalent, tenebricose, oblocutor, teratomorphous, plurisecular, lutulent, or bawcock, Ken, which one are you voting for as the word that we are going to cause to enter common usage?
I feel like oblocutor is the one that we run across most often in our daily life. Tenebricose, quite frankly, we already have tenebrous, just step off. Teratomorphous, as you say, very valuable in writing. You know, we'll be using that phrase a lot, but an oblocutor is someone that we run into over and over and over again. It could just mean comment section, as far as I'm concerned. I'm amazed that we haven't brought it back. I'd also like to do a little shout out to plurisecular, which I think is very handy and very cool.
Those are both solidly argued. However, I'm afraid that I have to settle for omnivalent, because again, it's something that is useful, especially if you're writing superheroes or elder gods. And most specifically, it is the only term on this list that was coined by someone who was disbarred for hitting a guy with a cudgel in a pub.
Oh, well, once we add the hand-to-hand combat section of the dictionary, that does change the scores.
Exactly. Yeah, you never know what you find when you're going to start researching things. Omnivalent was coined in 1602 by the poet and lawyer John Davies, who, after the hitting a guy with a cudgel in a bar incident, became a favorite of Elizabeth I, and was influential in the formation of English law, as well as an official who had various posts in the Elizabethan era. But he was also a sort of an interesting character, and although himself was not omnivalent, he probably told Elizabeth that she was omnivalent.
I'll bet he was an oblocutor.
Either he or the person he hit with the cudgel was an oblocutor.
And none of them were bawcocks.
Yes. And now it's time to close up the word hut, but we're not going to stop using words in this podcast because I think there's some words in this here commercial. Caught in the spiral.
Four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green Campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green, God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Keep this podcast lucriferous by joining such beloved Patreon backers as
Andrew Cowie,
Bart Molio,
Josh King,
Carl Schmidt,
and Keelan O'Hay.
The whirr of the projector as it pierces the tenebricose atmosphere, the smell of the popcorn as it appeals to a plurisecular audience, and the stickiness under our feet, which may or may not be lucullant, welcome us once more to the center seat, center aisle of the Cinema Hut, where we are settling in for a, I would say, hip, perhaps even now, or groovy installment of the Fantasy Film Essentials. Because, yes, gentlemen and ladies and children of all ages, we are here for the 60s. And the 60s, although they actually start in 1963, the Borehill calendar starts them in 1960. And Robin, we have an Ingmar Bergman. And so perhaps, as could have been guessed by anyone who's ever listened to this podcast, this is yours. Tell us about The Devil's Eye.
Right. And after I tell you about that, I'll move back to some general observations about the 60s. So The Devil's Eye, Ingmar Bergman wanted to make The Virgin Spring, which those who know it is a harrowing medieval tale of sexual violence and revenge. And his producer said, no, you got to make us a comedy first. So Ingmar Bergman says, I'll show you a comedy. And he makes The Devil's Eye, in which the devil has a sty in his eye, which is caused by the existence in our contemporary world of a woman who is going to be married while still a virgin. So the devil relies on some of his most effective damned souls for this purpose, and sends Don Juan, played by Jarl Kuhl, and his longtime servant Pablo, played by Sturri Lagerwal, back to Earth to cause trouble in the household of this young woman and her young fiancé and the sort of Ned Flanders-ish pastor who is her father and the troubled invalid woman who is her mother. So this is Bergman taking all of the external devices of the comedic fantasy and ultimately turning them to extremely Bergman-esque ends. So even though this is supposed to be funny, in fact, there's a narrator, he keeps showing up to tell you it's funny. It's Gunnar Bjornstrand, who's a mainstay of Bergman films. In fact, particularly due to the sort of silent, pained performance of Jarl Kuhl as Don Juan, winds up being as much about torment and suffering as anything in the Bergman filmography. And people who know Bergman know that that is saying a lot. To move back to the general thing about the 60s is, this is our only segment covering the 60s because there are more fantasy films than ever, all inspired by Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, which we talked about last time, and the Hercules cycle, which we mentioned without making anything an essential. So suddenly there's a lot of films following in that mold, but they're not essential. We're going to get to one that's essential, but the other ones that are kind of like that, they're numerous, they're filling the drive-ins, but they're not as good as the two good ones. And so we have a situation where a glut has arisen, and therefore there's more of them, and they're not necessarily as great. So the ones we're talking about are kind of, with one exception, the exceptions to the rule. So, Ken, I assume you have not seen The Cassandra Cat.
I have not. I'm excited to hear about it. The Cassandra Cat, it's Czech, it sounds like, Wojtek Jasny, 1963.
Yes. So The Cassandra Cat, it's based on that well-known old saw, somewhat tired fairy tale about the cat who has really cool sunglasses, but if you take his sunglasses off, he changes the color of all the people around him, revealing their true personalities.
Oh, that old chestnut.
That old saw.
Jacob was yelling, you know, at Johan, you can't put that in the tales. Everyone knows that tale. Get it out of here. The right. Sunglasses cat. Come on.
So this follows the Czech pattern of sort of wryly undermining Eastern Bloc authority in a sort of a gentle satirical way. So it centers around a teacher in this small town who wants to inspire his young kids and open up their imaginations and make them creative. And then there's the school director who also is covertly sort of the chief political officer and most influential member of the town who meets with the other town conservatives to thwart anything that's imaginative or opposed to rationality.
John Lithgow in Footloose, but make him communist.
Exactly, yes. And because it's a Czech film made during the communist era, subtly so, right? A deft hand is used here. But at any rate, the castellan of the town tells the story of the cat with the cool sunglasses. And then, miraculously, a carnival comes to town led by a stage musician who looks exactly like the castellan. It's not the same person because they meet up and comment on their visual similarity to one another. Played by Jan Werich, who's sort of the Czech Burl Ives. But at any rate, there's a beautiful woman in the circus, and she appeals to Robert, the teacher, and they fall in love. But the sunglasses are finally removed, and everyone in town is revealed. And just as in the story that has already been told, the reaction to the people who've been turned yellow, meaning they're adulterers, or gray, meaning they're thieves, or purple, meaning they're liars or hypocrites or snitches or social climbers, they don't like that. And so, just as in the original story, they hunt down and try to kill the cat.
No!
But at the end of the day, love and beauty and magic and cats with cool sunglasses. You're going to ask me, Ken, how cool are the sunglasses? They're very cool.
How cool are the sunglasses? I assume the cat is cool.
Yeah, he's a stripy cat, the best kind of cat.
Ah, love a stripy cat.
Yes, so the Cassandra Cat, which is on the Criterion Collection. So I'm not just naming an incredibly obscure thing that no one can see. It's readily available. Is a real sort of hidden treasure of fantasy cinema with a beautiful feeling of fantastic whimsy throughout.
Now, I'm assuming that the cat is animated into a live-action movie?
No, this is a live-action film. It's a live cat with live cool sunglasses.
So it's a live-action cat with live-action sunglasses. I love it even more now.
Yeah, the animated cat, that's no achievement having cool sunglasses. This is a real cat with real cool sunglasses.
Well, there we go. The Eastern Bloc was ahead of America in many important respects in the 1960s, from space to cat sunglasses technology. But one of the things they were not ahead of us in, Robin, is stop motion animation. And that was thanks to the efforts of Ray Harryhausen Jr., who is the real star, I guess, of Jason and the Argonauts, 1963. And I think you could do a really good trivia night sometime by asking people to name the director of Ray Harryhausen movies. But the director of this one of record is a guy named John Chaffee. And Jason and the Argonauts, you know, it's a Ray Harryhausen sword and sandal classic. It's one of the best of that breed, which means it's actually pretty great. And as you mentioned, Robin, we named them by the cool monsters. So this is the one with the Hydra, the one with the Colossus, the one with the Harpies, and the one with the whole bunch of skeletons instead of just the single skeleton from Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. We are now up to a squad of skeletons, and it's very exciting, and it's a cool fight. It works, you know, absolutely today. It's still a magnificent set piece of both action and special effects. And I love it unreservedly.
Yes, it is the best of the Harryhausen films. It is the classic one you're thinking of. A couple of trivia notes before we move on. Both actors, leads, Todd Armstrong as Jason and Nancy Kovac as Medea, were both English-American actors who spoke English, but were nonetheless both of them dubbed. And Doctor Who fans will also be excited to see Patrick Troughton, the second Doctor, in a small role as Phineas.
And Avengers fans will be excited to see Honor Blackman as Hera. And from the goddess Hera, protector of the household, we go to the entirely unrelated Mary Poppins, 1964, Robert Stevenson, based somewhat loosely on the book by P.L. Travers from 1934. This is the Julie Andrews Dick Van Dyke classic, a movie that you can still cause British people to shrink away from you and mock or feigned horror by mentioning because it is that good. And Dick Van Dyke's Cockney accent is that strong and authentic.
It's their favorite terrible accent that Dick Van Dyke has.
Right. And this one does have animated stuff into it. Penguins and all manner of exciting things. It's a masterpiece of putting animation into live action and vice versa. For those souls who don't remember it, there are children of a banker or a guy who works at a bank named Mr. Banks. Even the P.L. Travers subtlety, not her strong suit. And the poor children are left alone at home and a nanny shows up to nanny them. And the nanny, of course, is Mary Poppins. And she says, banking, fah, there are deeper and more powerful and more beautiful and dangerous fantasy truths. And they go on a series of fun adventures, and there's wonderful songs, all of it in the service of the occult system of George Gurdjieff, who I believe we've covered on the show, because P.L. Travers was a Gurdjieffite of great devotion. And so if you watch it with that fantasy tradition in mind, you will have an even greater time than you will just watching it normally. And watching it normally, as I mentioned, just a rousing good time. And again, the sort of unconstrained fantasy from before the monoculture, where basically anything could happen because the whole point of fantasy was there was no rules. And it wasn't about, you know, oh no, red dragons are bad and gold dragons are good. It was just, I don't know, penguins, they should dance.
Yes. And this is another one where the text is about fantasy, about embracing the imagination. Ed Wynn has a unforgettable turn as Uncle Albert, who floats when he laughs, which I guess is something Gurdjieff did. Mm-hmm. And if you want to see a fictionalized version of the making of Mary Poppins, there's a film called Saving Mr. Banks from 2013, which Tom Hanks plays Disney, Emma Thompson plays Travers, who was very resistant to letting Disney Disneyfy her work, but was finally won over. So that's a fun little side note there. It does not mention Gurdjieff, if I recall correctly.
Oh.
So we've come to 64, which is where, if we were mentioning Wu Sha films, which as previously mentioned are A, absolutely fantasy, and B, not the thing we want to talk about in this context because they would then take over the whole list and they are better understood in the history of martial arts films than in history of fantasy films.
If you thought ghost romances were bad in the 40s, just imagine if we were doing Wu Sha films. This would keep going until 2027.
Because there are just so many good ones, but they would start with King Hu's Come Drink With Me in 1964. Instead, we're now going to shift into something that's a full-on 60s from 1968, And that's Yellow Submarine, directed by the animators George Dunning and Dick Emery. If you have no idea where the song Yellow Submarine comes from, you must be very young, because, of course, it's a classic Beatles song. This is the third Beatles movie. They did not want to appear in another live-action film after making Help, which, unaccountably, they did not like at all, even though it's a classic rock and roll film. And so they agreed to have a animated film made with their more recent, at that time, psychedelic songs. And they did not even voice themselves as the animated characters. They show up very briefly at the end in live action to sort of grudgingly endorse this whole endeavor. But it's an incredible classic of animation. It is extremely trippy, as one would expect and hope. Mm-hmm. The art director is a Czech-German named Heinz Edelman. People think that Peter Max, later, who shortly afterwards would become famous for adopting a pop art style that looks a lot like Yellow Submarine, designed this film, but he did not. Edelman designed it, and he was there first. But this is a fantasy odyssey adventure in which the Beatles are confronted by such monsters as the Apple Droppers, the Dreadful Flying Glove, and of course, the Blue Meanies, led by the head Blue Meanie. So, classic rock film, an animated film that opened everybody's eyes as to what the dimensions of animation could be, as opposed to just strictly Disney, and a fun watch, even if you're watching it completely sober.
And makes a good double feature with the science fiction 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea with George Mason as Captain Nemo. So not quite of the same era, though I believe still of the same decade, but there's commonality to that vibe, and partly that's because Dunning and Emery were ripping it off. And so it's good fun to sort of put those together and look at that sort of Vernian voyage extraordinaire and think of it, you know, rather than going into the actual ocean, it goes into the Jungian ocean, the psychological ocean, and great fun had by all. Yeah, it's as you say, Robin, it's a trippy psychedelic fun ride, more of a carnival experience, I think, than a film per se, but it's certainly a vibe and great fun. And the fact that the Beatles did it grudgingly, frankly, makes it even better as far as I'm concerned. So there we go. With that, we have gotten ourselves through the 1960s without being unveiled by a cool cat with sunglasses or stabbed by a skeleton. And on that note, then, we leave the cinema hut and blink in the outside sunlight of this wonderful advertisement.
The British are coming! The British are coming!
In Flagbearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated in Nations and Cannons, you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The new campaign guide, The American Crisis, War in the North, covers the early actions of the war with historical adventures, setting information, and a fiendish Hessian plot.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
Educators can get a copy of the core book for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The American Crisis is currently released as a PDF with physical pre-orders available.
Visit nationsandcannons.com to check out a free adventure chapter and the quick start guide.
It's time once more to wend our way up the creepity cobweb stairs. We're going to stop on the landing and wave to the fire salamander, the king of the fire elementals. And wait a minute, he's making us take a retinal scan and undergo a background check, because we're not just going to consult the consulting occultist, but there's a bit of a tradecraft element to this, because beloved Patreon backer Christopher Hattie wants to know about Alexandra David Niel. And Ken, this is a fascinating and very detailed story, which I will let you take away.
Right. Alexandra is born Alexandra David in 1868 in the Paris suburb of Saint-Mandé. Her dad was in the 1848 revolution, so they are radical parents. Her mom is Belgian, which I guess is not radical, but is a thing. And in 1873, even under the Republic, their politics are so sketched that they have to move back to Belgium, to basically her mom's place. So mom is from that point kind of in the saddle in the household. This does not comport well with Alexandra. Mom wanted a boy so that she could raise him to be a priest. Alexandra starts running away from home and basically does that for the whole rest of her long and eventful life. In 1883, she gets a letter from a mysterious patron named Mrs. Elizabeth Morgan, who sends her occult literature from the Society of Supreme Gnosis, which I have not been able to track down any further, except they were the people who sent Alexandra David Niel that letter. And so she dodges her family, goes off to London, meets with Mrs. Morgan. Mrs. Morgan says, oh my God, you're 15. You have to go back to Belgium. But that's where she starts getting into theosophy, is when she's in London. The theosophical movement is churning around, although the formal theosophical society hasn't quite started. In 1886, mom thinks, well, how do I keep my daughter out of trouble? I know. I'll put her in music class. That's never gotten anyone into trouble.
I'll put her on the stage to keep her out of trouble.
Exactly. She gets music and voice training at the Royal Conservatory of Brussels. By now, she is very much a feminist and anarchist. She is a feminist because she doesn't want to stay at home and do what her mom wants. And she's an anarchist because her dad was, as I mentioned, an anarchist. She is neighbors at this point in Belgium with the anarchist geographer Élisée Reclus. He's been a friend of her dad since forever, and he is also a pal of Jules Verne. He is.
And you can only be an anarchist geographer if your name is Élisée Reclus. There's no other life path for you.
Yeah, well, he's one of the fathers of ecology as a political project, as well as ecology as a science. He's quite a guy, and is also, you know, sort of on the radar of a lot of anarchist groups. So he's sort of a clearinghouse, if you will, for a lot of the anarchist movement in Europe by 1888.
A mission assigner? He can give us missions? This is getting even better.
Could he be? Could he sit there in his room full of globes and maps and say, your mission, should you choose to accept it? And Jules Verne says, to find a comet. It's like, stop it, Jules. We're talking about real missions now. In 1888, at age 20, she is back in London, back out from under her mother's thumb. She is studying now and living at the Supreme Gnosis. She studies at the British Museum. She's teaching herself English, which is what she needs in order to become a scholar of Asia, or Orientalist, as they called it back in the day. Her boyfriend at the time is the painter Jacques Villeman, who, again, is only indexed as that guy Alexandra David Niel dated. But he does warn her that sometimes people fall into his paintings and enter the world behind the canvas, which is a great thing to just be mentioning. I think it was just a line that he used that turned out it worked. He painted a sort of a Himalaya-looking mountain that she was sort of obsessed with. And I think that that was one of the things that sort of inspires her as well.
So his line was, do you want to come to my place to fall into one of my paintings?
Fall into one of my paintings, exactly. Come back and see my mountain. In 1889, because of her studies, she has been going to various Buddhist scriptures and whatnot and converts to Buddhism. And later on introduces herself to the Dalai Lama as the only Buddhist in Belgium, which makes him laugh and laugh and laugh. She studies Tibetan and Sanskrit at the Collège de France and at the École Pratique des Hautes Études. These are both very, very high-end universities that do not admit women. So she just shows up and takes classes and nobody says boo to her because she's certainly got a great deal of stick-to-itiveness.
Yes. Women were at that time allowed to show up and audit classes. They just couldn't get a degree or get professional accreditation, but they could learn everything they wanted for free. So that's the other side of that coin.
Yeah. It's hard to send a bill if you're not also giving a degree. She may also have been recruited into an anarchist underground at this point, according to her main biographer. She is doing an awful lot of traveling around from Belgium to France to London to Italy. And she's carrying a lot of money for someone who is in music and Tibetan class. In 1890, she joins the Theosophical Society itself. She also joins Scottish Rite Masonry, which is the masonry that admits women. Eventually, she'll be rising to the 30th degree of that. In 1891, she visits India for the first time and does, in fact, get up to the Himalayas. Her big stop is at the Theosophical Compound at Adyar. She and Annie Besant, the Indian nationalist and theosophist, sort of one of the four mothers of Indian revolutionary consciousness, and she become good buddies. By 1895, however, she has got the position of lead singer of the Hanoi Opera, because Hanoi, of course, is a French colony. So if you've studied in a France-adjacent conservatory, you're on the list. And off she goes. She spends 2 years as the premier voice talent at the Hanoi Opera, although she winds up singing Carmen too much, which is outside her range, and it starts to wreck her voice. And that's part of the problem. And in 1897, her Carmen has not been a success. She comes back to Paris.
Don't sing mezzo when you're soprano. That's a lesson that we repeat again and again on this.
Exactly. Show. Over and over. A tale as old as time. A tale as old as a cool sunglasses cat. She tries to break into showbiz, and she tries to break into art. She tries to break into politics, various things in Paris. This is the Yellow King era almost. And in 1898, mad at the art community, she writes a hymn to anarchism called Pour la Vie. No publisher, including the anarchist ones, would touch it because it is feminist and anarchist and very fiery. She gets it privately printed by her boyfriend at the time, and it becomes very influential. It's translated into 7 languages, and good old Élisée Reclus writes the foreword to it. So there we are.
Just like the King in Yellow, it's good to be suppressed. It's good for some publicity.
Right. Good for her vibe. Although it doesn't turn you into a degenerate, it turns you into someone who believes in apocalyptic Buddhism, apparently. 1899, she goes to Athens for the Athens Opera's winter program. Doesn't stick it out there. 1900, she is now the second lead at the opera in Tunis. So this is very definitely you're playing the county fair circuit in opera. And she meets an engineer named Philippe Neel de Saint-Sauveur in Tunis. He is sort of the Casanova of that little social circle and sweeps her off her feet. He's a big adventurous guy like Élisée Reclus was. And they marry in 1904. And because of her politics and his politics, it is understood that while they will be married in every sense, she will also not be sticking around to sew up Philippe Saint-Sauveur's socks. She's got other stuff to do. She has already, by this time, got a reputation as a journalist. The Pour la Vie has made her famous as a feminist and an anarchist. She's written a number of radical essays. And in this period also, she writes a history of Buddhism, laying out the difference between archaic Buddhism, the Buddhism of Buddha, and the current versions of Buddhism, and sort of is one of the first people to explain Tibetan versus Theravada versus Hinayana to everyone in Europe, basically. 1911, she heads back to India. And the trip may or may not have been sponsored by the French government, which is another one of those question mark things, because it's not like she had a ton of money from anywhere. She is spied on as she arrives in India, which is another thing that makes one think that maybe there's something going on. The India office has very complete records of her travel in India, and it is all in a big folder labeled French Nun. That was her code name.
Right. So if you're spied upon, it's possible that you are a spy, hence the tradecraft hut.
And again, she is moving around at an era where that was a upper middle class sort of a thing to do without, you know, an opera contract explaining in this case why she's doing it. The Raja of Nepal sponsors her trip to Nepal and Sikkim. Again, could the French have been writing to the Raja of Nepal and saying, you're not fond of being run by Britain? Maybe bring this cool French lady up and talk to her. And he welcomes her to Nepal and then says, have you gone to Sikkim, this place that you can't undermine me in? And she goes off and she meets the crown prince of Sikkim, Sid Kheong, and becomes his confidant and spiritual sister. Is there romance there? Again, we don't know. She meets the exiled 13th Dalai Lama, who has been run out of Tibet by the Chinese. reincarnation Israel, I guess. She studies Tibetan Buddhism under him and then under other teachers recommended by him. And it is here in Sikkim that she learns various yogic arts, including the art of tum, the inner fire, where it lets her sit in a snowbank without freezing to death. In 1914 in Sikkim, she meets a young monk named Afur Yongden. He is the sort of monk that sticks around when all the other monks are like, we can't be hanging around this lady. She's weird and dangerous and a foreigner. But he basically, his family says, look, you don't have to be a monk. We'll let you marry a nice lady if you come back home. And he's like, nope. I've joined myself to this weird French lady. In 1916, from Sikkim, she sneaks across the border into Tibet and meets the Panchen Lama, who is the Lama that was actually running things, at Shigatse. He's under observation, and the British throw her out of Sikkim for that. So she goes to Calcutta and then travels to Japan and studies with the Zen monk, Ikai Yamaguchi, who is also an agent of Japan's Black Ocean Society, which is a para-governmental combination of a aggressive think tank mafia and secret society that is basically about Japanese expansionism.
Right. So she's meeting a lot of spies.
Yes. He sets her up in Korea, which is at this time Japanese occupied. In 1918, she joins a Tibetan caravan in Korea, which takes her into China and from there into eastern Tibet. While with the caravan, she catches bubonic plague from a hospital car that is briefly attached to their train, but she gets better, gets over the bubonic plague, Robin. She beats it, possibly by Tibetan arts, who can say. In 1918, she fetches up in the Tibetan city of Kumbum, which is now not in Tibet. It's in Qinghai, which is the thing that the Chinese carved off of Tibet, the communists, after they took it over. She's in Kumbum until 1921. This is the point at which she decides, I'm going to go to Lhasa. And so she joins a different caravan that is going to go to Mongolia. So she goes up to Mongolia and then just stays with the caravan as a poor pilgrim. Basically, you wait out until everyone at the caravan who knew who you were leaves. And then she's just always been there as the poor pilgrim. And she comes back to Lhasa and she's there with Yongden. She stays there for 2 months incognito as a peasant, but she does get to go into the Potala Palace and a lot of other places, and then heads to Gyatse. And basically, Lhasa's getting a little too hot to hold her. She goes to Gyatse. She is very sick and has run out of money. And so she sort of turns herself into the British observer in Gyatse. And he's like, go away. And she says, no, no, I'm a French lady. I'm not Tibetan. And he is full of curiosity, quizzes her about Lhasa. She convinces him that, yes, she's gone to Lhasa because she needs him to not throw her out in the street. But of course, once he has found out she's gone to Lhasa, which is against the British rules, he then has to throw her out of Gyatse. But he gives her like 24 hours head start. So she gets back to France the next year via India and stays there and writes a book, My Journey to Lhasa, which was published in 27. By 28, Philippe Niel and she have decided that being at least a few provinces apart is the best thing for their marriage. So she moves to Provence, a little town named Digne-les-Bains, and sort of falls in love with the feng shui of a given house, moves in and names it San Ten Zong, the Fortress of Meditation, and buys it. And that's her headquarters for the rest of her life, except that, of course, she's Alexander David Niel, and she's not going to stay anywhere for the rest of her life.
Right. And that is it's still extant as a museum to her. So if you're in the neighborhood, you can stop by for a couple of hours and check out all of her memorabilia.
That's where she writes, and then in 1929 publishes Magic and Mystery in Tibet, which the technical title is With Magicians and Mystics in Tibet, but no one translates it that way. And this is her sort of anthropological, practical Bon and practical Tibetan Buddhism, not so much the theology of it, which is why it's the giant big seller. Among other things, it describes the process of making a tulpa, and it brings the word tulpa into Western occultism. It had not been there until just now. In 1937, she is tired of living in idyllic Provence and decides, I'm going to take the Trans-Siberian Railway to Peking, and I'm going to study ancient Taoism. I've pretty much done Buddhism. I'm going to do Taoism now. And by the time she gets to Peking, the Japanese have invaded. She has to, you know, go into the countryside ahead of the Japanese forces. And she spends a time in various, you know, Wuhan, Chengdu, and then eventually says, well, nothing for it, and goes back to Tibet. And this time she's in the city of Darcedo or Ta Chien Lu in Tibet. That's 1938 to 1943. Once the war is over, she goes back through India and then in 1946, returns to France. Her husband has died in 1941. She deals with his estate. Yongden dies in 1955. He has been adopted as her son some time ago. And then in 1969, she dies covered in glory at the age of 100. Quite a life. And, you know, her wandering around in Tibet is done in her 50s and 60s and 70s. This is not, you know, when she is a spring chicken anymore. She is remarkable. And was right. Remarked upon.
But her story doesn't end with her death at the age 100, because in 1972, there's a short pseudonymous book called A. David Niel in Tibet, in which this person who doesn't put her real name on it claims that she faked everything, that she'd never been to Tibet, that she didn't speak Tibetan, that she hadn't met any of the people that she claimed to have met. Now, I think the Indian Secret Service with their dossier possibly would say something different.
Yeah, right.
And indeed, in 1976, the scholar Bram Norwick was the one who took on the task of providing evidence that she really had done all of those things. And she's sort of a hero among Westerners who were interested in Tibet because they first were introduced to Tibet through her book. So he publishes a refutation of his claims, calls them libelous. And he has figured out that the person who wrote this was someone who stayed at the Fortress of Meditation for a couple of weeks, just I think when Niel was in her 90s and they didn't get along. And I guess she didn't make with the immediate New Age revelations. And so this person decided she was a phony and wrote a book to that effect.
Yeah, she basically signed up to index Alexandra David Niel's papers, much as P.L. Travers indexed Gurdjieff's papers, but instead of writing a beloved children's classic, wrote a slanderous lie. So there we are.
Right. And it's written all in that sort of just picking apart details of a story that you don't really understand style. It's like, well, this doesn't make any sense that this happened in this, but that's, you know, that sort of conspiratorial writing. But that, of course, did not damage Niel's reputation. And today she's been adopted as a feminist anarchist hero. And so today you can find her as the inspiration for such academic papers as Anarchist Women and the Politics of Walking or Travel, Gender, and the Exotic. So she's very much in the thoughts of people from all sorts of different traditions.
And worth it, because she's great.
Yeah. And gaming-wise, she's obviously a player character. She's definitely got player character energy. You might be tracking down a Talpa and have to go talk to her when she's around in the, I guess you have to find her. If you're in Trail of Cthulhu times, I guess you can find her up to 36 before you have to take the Trans-Siberian Railway to track her down for information about Eldritch Talpas. And of course, she's sufficiently long-lived that you can also put her in a Fall of Delta Green game.
And as I mentioned, she's in Paris. It's before she goes off to become the Queen of Tibet, but she's in Paris and doing cool anarchist stuff in and around 1895, although she's technically in Hanoi. But again, maybe she bilocates herself back in time to do her singing in Hanoi while her real self carries out anarchist anti-Carcosan spy work in Paris. And that's why her operatic career doesn't take off, is because it's just a bilocated Talpa doing the singing. It's not actual Alexandra.
Yeah, you got to have serious pipes if you're going to be a Talpa opera singer, and few of them have it. Well, since we've shown that she spans three of our occult mystery games, we've done our work for this week. We can pat ourselves on the back and promise to return a mere 7 days from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flag Bearer Games.
Dark Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/CanonRobin.
Preserve this podcast's sky of blue and sea of green by joining such backers as
Louis Sylvester,
Ross Ireland,
Stephen Hammond,
Todd W. Olson,
and Andrew Dacey.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Canon Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Grab our latest design, Subtlety is for People Who Forgot Their Battering Ram.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.